Thanks for tuning in to Women's Voices. My name is Genevieve Gluck, and in this episode, Holly Lawford-Smith reads her essay, The Metaphysics of Intersectionality Revisited. Lawford-Smith co-authored the paper with Kate Phelan, and it was published in the Journal of Political Philosophy. Holly Lawford-Smith is an associate professor in political philosophy in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne. She works in social, moral, and political philosophy, with a particular interest in feminism, climate ethics, and collective action. Most of her current research is centered on the conflict of interest between gender identity activism on the one hand, and both women's rights and lesbian, gay, and bisexual rights on the other hand. In May, she published her debut book, titled Gender Critical Feminism, which analyzes the new view of gender that has emerged in recent years as an identity, a way that people feel about themselves in terms of masculinity or femininity, regardless of their sex. According to Lawford-Smith, women are socialized to conform to norms of femininity and sanctioned for failure, and masculinity and femininity exist in a hierarchy in which femininity is devalued. This view, she argues, helps us to understand injustice against women and what we can do about it. In this paper, The Metaphysics of Intersectionality Revisited, Lawford-Smith articulates some of the ways intersectionality is being interpreted to the detriment of the women's movement and attempts to clarify the history behind the concept. The insights of early Black feminists on this topic were original, imaginative, and important, and they pointed to an urgent gap in social justice-oriented theory and politics, say Lawford-Smith and Phelan. Here we are not questioning their significance, but rather the way the concept of intersectionality has been taken up in contemporary mainstream feminism, both inside and outside the academy. The idea of intersectionality has assumed enormous cultural importance, but it is variously deployed in ways that seem far from what its originators had in mind.
The Metaphysics of Intersectionality Revisited. Holly Lawford-Smith, University of Melbourne, and Kate Phelan, RMIT. Leslie McCall wrote in the journal Science in 2015, intersectionality is the most important contribution that women's studies, in conjunction with other fields, has made so far. There's a whole journal dedicated to intersectional thought, the Journal of Intersectionality. Kimberly Crenshaw, the Black feminist legal theorist credited with coining the term, has a 2016 TED Talk titled The Urgency of Intersectionality. The agreed conclusions of the United Nations 61st Commission on the Status of Women included the phrase multiple and intersecting forms of discrimination four times. It's common for university campuses to be plastered with posters reading, "If your feminism isn't intersectional, it's bullshit." Popular pieces on the topic have appeared in The Conversation, The Guardian, Vox, and even Time. It's absolutely clear to anyone who has any contact with feminism at all, activist or academic, that their feminism had better be intersectional. Less clear is exactly what that means. Here's one gloss. Features of identity intersect to create a subject of new forms of oppression. For example, sex and class intersect to produce the subject of working class women's oppression. Race and sex intersect to produce the subject of Black women's oppression. Many people who advocate intersectionality would probably agree with this gloss. But if we were to take the observation at face value, it wouldn't be obvious why it's a specifically feminist claim. At face value, it simply suggests that there's more oppression than single identity feature movements or theories have accounted for. So the idea of intersections would be a recognition that the anti-racism movement, feminist movement, and anti-class stratification movement, taken together, were missing something. Falling through the cracks would be the way they overlap, the way that people can be caught between them, or doubly, even triply oppressed by combinations of them. It might suggest that we need a new intersectional justice movement, or perhaps many new movements, one for race and sex, one for sex and class, one for race and class, and one for race and sex and class, and more if more things are oppressions. But that is not the way the observation has been incorporated. McCall's claim was that this is the most important contribution of women's studies. It is presented as a specifically feminist claim about what feminism must be like. And its uptake within feminism seems to have had some peculiar effects. For example, the @UNWomen Twitter account, which is the account of the United Nations Entity for Gender Equality and the Empowerment of Women, or UN Women for short, has tweeted a definition of feminist as a person who believes in and stands up for the political, economic, and social equality of human beings. Human beings, not women. Or to give another example, one International Women's Day collective's list of demands issued in advance of the IWD 2019 March had only 3 out of 20 that were straightforwardly about women. The remaining 17 covered such diverse topics as an end to all imperialist wars, free and accessible healthcare for all, access to permanent residence and citizenship rights for all refugees and migrant workers, and an end to environmental destruction and compensation for all victims worldwide. Feminism, in virtue of being directed to pay attention to the ways that various features of identity can overlap, has somehow become a movement for all social justice issues. The insights of early Black feminists on this topic were original, imaginative, and important, and they pointed to an urgent gap in social justice-oriented theory and politics. Here we are not questioning their significance, but rather the way that the concept of intersectionality has been taken up in contemporary mainstream feminism, both inside and outside the academy. The idea of intersectionality has assumed enormous cultural importance, but it's furiously deployed in ways that seem far from what its originators had in mind. As a contribution to adding clarity to this sometimes confused and confusing situation, we aim to do 2 things in this article. First, we undertake a conceptual analysis of the claim that feminism must be intersectional. We focus on the original work done by Black feminists, mostly during the second wave of feminism, resulting in a typology of 6 possible interpretations, section 2. Second, we dig further into the most philosophically complicated of those interpretations, in particular, the metaphysical and explanatory, section 3. In that section, we disagree with a recent proposal made by Sarah Bernstein. Our conclusion is that it is false that feminism had better be intersectional instead of single-axis focused, and at best true that feminism had better also be intersectional in addition to its single-axis focus. Section 1. Disambiguating intersectionality. Across the early literature on intersectionality, it's possible to distinguish at least 6 distinct types of claim. These are routinely conflated in the sense that they are never distinguished, and so it is never made clear which one is being invoked, despite being very different and giving very different meaning to what it would be for feminism to be intersectional in that particular sense. They are 1. Experiential/phenomenological, 2. Doxastic/epistemic, 3. Legal, 4. Explanatory, 5. Applied ethical/political, 6. Metaphysical. Subsection A, experiential/phenomenological. What is it like to be oppressed in more than one way is an interesting question, one whose answer might underwrite a particular type of belief or knowledge transmittable through testimony, and therefore vulnerable to testimonial injustice. The documentary On the Record contains interviews with Black women raped or sexually assaulted by Russell Simmons, several talking about how they were reluctant to come forward because this would feed into negative stereotypes about Black men and so further harm the Black community. This is experiential. What it is like to be a Black woman who has been sexually assaulted by a Black man is to be conflicted about whether to report or speak out in ways that are not part of the considerations of other women. subsection B, doxastic/epistemic. Bell Hooks says in Feminist Theory that Black women have a unique perspective in being oppressed without also being an oppressor. White women are both, oppressed as women but oppressor as white. Black men are both, oppressed as black but oppressor as men. Black women, however, have no institutionalized other that we may discriminate against, exploit, or oppress. She says, this lived experience may shape our consciousness in such a way that our worldview differs from those who have a degree of privilege. She goes on to suggest that this is a reason for Black women to make use of their perspective in order to criticize the status quo and create a vision of something better. This is a claim about intersectionality in beliefs or knowledge, coming from a particular perspective that a person has upon the world in light of her experiences, and therefore it is closely related to intersectionality as experiential / phenomenological as discussed above. In principle, a woman who is oppressed in more than one way might have an experience that is clearly recognizable to her as relating to one system of oppression, for example, a Black woman being subject to sexual harassment. That in fact relates to one system of oppression, but where it is not detectable to her which system. For example, a white male hiring committee is clearly unimpressed with a Black woman applicant. It turns out this was because they are sexists, but she herself could not tell whether it was sexism, racism, both, or something else entirely. That is clearly recognizable to her as relating to multiple systems of oppression. For example, a Black woman being subject to racialized sexual harassment, perhaps something that fetishizes racial features or applies familiar racial stereotypes in a sexualized way, or that in fact relates to multiple systems of oppression, but where this is not detectable to her. For example, the lecturer constantly fails to call on her in discussion because she has prejudices against Black and women students. So how her experience feeds into her belief / knowledge depends on the transparency of the oppressive behavior. Subsection C, legal. Kimberly Crenshaw showed that there are gaps in the law which mean that some people have no recourse against discrimination because of the way multiple features of their identities intersect. She gave three legal cases to make this point. In the first, a company hired Black men and white women, and so could not be prosecuted for discrimination in hiring on the grounds of either race or sex, even though they had laid off all their Black women employees. The court said it was reluctant to create new classes of protected minorities by combination. In the second, the female employees of a company attempted to bring a case for discrimination on the grounds of sex, but the court refused to certify their representative, a Black woman, saying there were serious doubts as to her ability to adequately represent the white female employees. This was ostensibly because it wasn't clear whether she was discriminated against on the grounds of her sex or her race. In the third case, the court accepted two Black women as representatives in a race-based discrimination case against their company, but denied that they could represent all Black employees, accepting them as representing Black women only. This was ostensibly because it expected sex to make a difference to race-based discrimination. Employment discrimination and lack of protection against discrimination under the law are both serious structural obstacles. An intersectional approach to the law helps to guard against people having to face these obstacles. But note that this is an argument for intersectional approaches to supplement existing approaches, not for intersectional approaches to replace existing approaches. If there were only intersectional approaches, then there would be no anti-discrimination protection for example, middle-class white women, middle-class black men, or working-class white men, all of whom are oppressed only by a single aspect of identity rather than multiple aspects. So this couldn't yet make sense of the claim that feminism had better be intersectional, only the weaker claim that feminism had better be intersectional too, as well as in addition to. Subsection D, explanatory. This version of the claim is most vivid in the chapter Feminist Movement to End Violence in Bell Hooks' Feminist Theory. Hooks explains male violence as the product of both worker exploitation, class, and male domination, sex. She writes, "As workers, most men in our culture, like working women, are controlled, dominated. Unlike working women, working men are fed daily a fantasy diet of male supremacy and power. In actuality, they have very little power, and they know it. Yet they do not rebel against the economic order or make revolution. They are socialized by ruling powers to accept their dehumanization and exploitation in the public world of work. And they are taught to expect that the private world, the world of home and intimate relationships, will restore them their sense of power, which they equate with masculinity. The male worker is subject to the authority of another in the workplace in a way that he experiences as humiliating or degrading. Because he cannot express his frustration in that context without risking reprisal, loss of job or imprisonment, he expresses it in a context where there is not the same risk, namely at home. This will often mean violence against a female partner. It is sex/gender that explains why negative emotions often end up expressed as violence rather than in more healthy or constructive ways, but it is class that explains why those negative emotions are so frequently provoked. An intersectional approach to understanding male violence gives us a better explanation of the phenomena of male violence than we would have had if we'd looked only at male domination or only at class exploitation." Subsection E, applied ethical/political. The Combahee River Collective, whose best known member from today's perspective was Audre Lorde, wrote in 1977 that black feminism evolved out of black women's disillusionment with both black liberation and feminism. They wrote about the need to develop a politics that was anti-racist, unlike those of white women, and anti-sexist, unlike those of black and white men. And they gave an early statement of what is now called identity politics, when they said, "We realize that the only people who care enough about us to work consistently for our liberation is us. And the most profound and potentially radical politics come directly out of our own identity, as opposed to working to end somebody else's oppression." This is a political claim. People who face multiple sources of oppression care more and will produce more profound and radical politics than someone not situated in the same way. Hooks also seems to be making an applied ethical/political claim when she says that feminists should be working against all violence and domination, not just against male violence and male domination. One reason she gives for this is that if we don't do this, we won't be able to solve the problem. The reasoning is something like, you can't end a single symptom. You have to go to the root cause and end that, which will in turn end all the symptoms. She denies that male domination is one of the fundamental contributing elements when it comes to male violence. Rather, she thinks Western philosophy brought ideas about hierarchy and authority into the culture, and these are the common base of all forms of domination, of violence against women, of adult violence against children, of all violence between those who dominate and those who are dominated. The feminist concern with male violence against women and girls is, on this view, concerned with a single symptom. If we actually want to get rid of that violence, we'd better focus on getting rid of Western ideas about authority and hierarchy, particularly the idea that the superior have a natural right to rule the inferior. If we can do that, we'll get rid of male violence and other kinds of violence too. An intersectional approach to desired applied ethical or political outcomes is more likely to be efficacious. Subsection F, metaphysical. Anna Julia Cooper, as early as 1892, talked about race, class, gender, and region being interdependent and so not able to be examined in isolation. the Combahee River Collective in 1977 talked about their struggle against racial, sexual, heterosexual, and class oppression, stating that the major systems of oppression are interlocking. Both Frances Beale in 1969 and Deborah King in 1988 talked about the categories of gender, race, class, and sexuality as being mutually constitutive. Beale in a way that could be read as additive, King arguing for something like multiplicative. Beale uses the phrase double jeopardy, describing the dual burdens of racism and sexism faced by Black women in the early 1970s, while King uses the phrase multiple jeopardy to signal that the relationships among various discriminations are not merely additive. All of these are metaphysical claims that whatever there is in the world that produces oppression or domination is mixed slash interdependent slash mutually constitutive and so on. Let's gloss this as the idea that intersectional oppression is more than the sum of its parts. Crenshaw uses this locution explicitly. The intersectional experience is greater than the sum of racism and sexism. In what seems to be the first article to fully take up the question of the metaphysics of the claim from an analytic philosophical perspective, Sarah Bernstein focuses on the metaphysics of intersectional identity categories like sex and race, defending the idea that intersectionality is best understood as metaphysical and explanatory priority of the intersectional category over its constituents, on par with grounding claims in contemporary analytic metaphysics. She makes use of the metaphysical concepts of determinables, like color and shape, and determinants, like being red or being circular. Race, gender, and class are social determinables. Everyone has them, and you can't have one without the rest. But features like being Black, being female, or being working class are social determinants. You can have one and not the others. Thinking about it in this way, intersectionality is the claim that social determinants are inseparable. It's not just that you are Black and female, it is that Blackness and femaleness are inseparable. This fits with Elizabeth Spelman's analysis when she writes, "Some women may be told by white feminists that they aren't properly distinguishing their voices as women from their voices as Afro-Americans, or Jews, or members of the working class." She thinks this doesn't make sense. Nothing I might point to would meet the requirements of being a part of me that was a woman part that was not also a white part. Any part of my body is a part of a body that is, by prevailing criteria, female and white. But this still leaves us with a question of how to understand inseparability. Bernstein proposes a stronger and a weaker understanding. On the weaker, inseparability just means interaction. Blackness and femaleness interact in the experience of Black women. But she offers a stronger understanding too, in order to accommodate accounts of intersectionality on which the different identity categories constitute or construct each other. The stronger understanding is explanatory unity, which justifies giving priority to the intersectional category, for example, race slash sex, rather than its elements, race, sex. Bernstein says, "In understanding Black womanhood, we thereby understand Blackness and womanhood. Being a Black woman explains being Black and being a woman. Features of Blackness and womanhood are at least partially explained by Black womanhood." This fits well with Spelman's view that there is no unified category woman, only categories like Black lesbian woman and working class disabled woman, although Bernstein's view allows that both categories exist and just gives priority to one, whereas Spelman's eliminates the larger category. Bernstein classifies her own interpretation of intersectionality as metaphysical, but the weaker understanding is experiential, our type 1, and the stronger understanding is explanatory, our type 4. We might want to argue for a merging of the explanatory and the metaphysical, but that would require the bridging assumption that the best explanation, where best is granted by a set of criteria, of which one is explanatory unity, is the true explanation, and therefore a reflection of the way the world is, so a metaphysical claim. But not all best explanations are true. Most obviously, where we use abstractions or idealizations for simplicity and explanatory power. For all that Bernstein says, this is simply the best way to make sense of what intersectionality is, given what the theorists of intersectionality that she focuses on have to say. So there's no claim yet to intersectionality as explanatory unity being true. We've mostly been using the example of a person's being both black and a woman, following black feminists, although sometimes, like the Combahee River Collective, they added in further sources of discrimination, like being working class or same-sex attracted. We take it that it would be possible to give a generalized version of the claim, which would not take any particular identity feature as necessary. But because we're specifically interested in the claim that feminism must be intersectional, we'll assume that being a woman is necessary, and so refer to being oppressed by sex plus at least one other feature. Here's the list of the disambiguated claims again, with a summary of what they each mean. 1. Experiential / phenomenological. Feminism must pay attention to what it's like to be oppressed by sex plus at least one other identity feature. 2. Doxastic / epistemic. Feminism must make use of the unique perspective, beliefs or knowledge of particular people gained through their particular lived experience, of women oppressed by sex plus at least one other identity feature. 3. Legal. Feminism must work for legal protection against discrimination for sex plus at least one other identity feature in combination, rather than for sex alone. 4. Explanatory. Feminism must seek explanations of women's oppression that draw on more than sex alone. 5. Applied ethical / political. Feminist activism must be focused on the intersectional categories at the root of all oppression, rather than on the single category of sex. 6. Metaphysical. Feminism must focus on the mitigation of novel forms of intersectional oppression, always including sex, but never only sex, which are more than the sum of their parts. And then 6 star, Bernstein, metaphysical. Feminism must always give explanatory priority to the intersectional categories. Thus spelled out, none of these is obviously true. It's not obvious, when we are implored to be intersectional, which of these we're supposed to be paying the most attention to. And even if it were clear that one in particular of these were usually the one being referred to, none of them is obviously superior to a feminism focused on the single axis of sex. We do not claim to have established that all of these understandings of the claim fail. We claim only that there is enough doubt about them that we should be cautious about replacing single axis feminism on their basis. We will outline our reasons for doubt about the intersectionality claims in the first 5 senses in the remainder of this section. In the next section, we will argue in substantially more detail that there is reason for caution about the metaphysical claim. We note that while Crenshaw is the most invoked theorist in association with intersectionality, most of those who invoke her are not advancing a specifically legal claim. And we've already noted that the claim is implausibly strong if it requires replacing single-axis anti-discrimination protections. The experiential / phenomenological and doxastic / epistemic claims can only be true if feminism is a project revealed through these mechanisms. The consciousness-raising groups popular during the second wave took this to be the case, but these individual rap groups also exhausted the virtues of consciousness raising and decided they wanted to do something more specific. Feminism is not only about consciousness raising, and when it isn't, it's not clear how important those two claims are, intersectional or not. the explanatory claim would go through only if the explanation of women's oppression is in fact more than sex alone. For example, a complicated merging of the systems of racism and sexism, or sexism and classism. There are multiple accounts arguing that it isn't. The same can be said for the ethical slash political claim that there are intersectional categories at the root of all oppression. But even if there were, it's not clear whether conceptualizing a mega global justice movement as about all oppression would actually rule out the permissibility of single-axis feminism. Why call the mega movement feminism? And wouldn't the mega movement be unwieldy? All the progressives in the world trying to fight for all the causes at once? So that for efficacy, it would need to be broken down into cells. Wouldn't one of those cells at some level be focused on sex? And if so, isn't that just a roundabout way of saying that single-axis feminism is perfectly fine? No feminist we know denies that feminist work feeds into more general social justice projects. In the next section, we'll focus on the two versions of the metaphysical claim. Section 2, more on the metaphysics. The metaphysical claim is arguably the most philosophically complicated, so whether or not it's the best candidate for what most theorists mean when they advocate for intersectionality in feminism, it's the one we'll give some more attention to. It is metaphysical intersectional claim. Feminism must focus on the mitigation of novel forms of intersectional oppression, always including sex but never only sex, which are more than the sum of their parts. First, we'll unpack the claim about intersectional oppression being more than the sum of its parts, and then we'll ask about the implications, whether it is or whether it isn't. If intersectional oppression is more than the sum of its parts, is the claim that it always is, or necessarily is, or only that it can be, or sometimes is? Does being the sum of its parts make it non-intersectional, or are all the combinations intersectional regardless of the interactions? Can intersectional oppression be less than the sum of its parts? Ultimately, the metaphysical intersectional claim is an empirical claim. Few offer empirical evidence to support it, but Crenshaw and Angela Davis are exceptions. We'll discuss both. We've already considered one example. In section one, we talked about the black women testifying to sexual assault and rape in On the Record, and the way that those women were more conflicted about reporting those offences because of the implications for the black male perpetrators in light of existing racism. Phyllis Chesler talks in her memoir about a number of feminists refusing to confront her rapist for similar reasons. Davis wrote about the myth of the black slave woman as matriarch, and the way this later functioned to attempt to undermine equality between black men and black women by suggesting that black women were castrators of black men, denying them their rightful place as the heads of families. Black women experienced the horrors of slavery alongside black men, and partly for that reason, black women feel more equality with black men in black liberation struggle. Because of that long-established equality, black women feel threatened by the matriarch myth, which taps into patriarchal ideology in an effort to disrupt their equality with black men. Black woman as matriarch is arguably one example of oppression that is more than the sum of its parts, racism and sexism. It would be hard to predict such a stereotype or mythological construction from merely putting what we know generally about racism together with what we know generally about sexism. Crenshaw also offers a number of examples, which she takes to show that black women experience discrimination that is not the sum of race and sex discrimination. In one example, Crenshaw suggests that white men have often raped black women, not as women generally, but as black women specifically. She writes, "When black women were raped by white males, they were raped not as women generally, but as black women specifically. Their femaleness made them sexually vulnerable to racist domination, while their blackness effectively denied them any protection. This white male power was reinforced by a judicial system in which the successful conviction of a white man for raping a black woman was virtually unthinkable. While she attributes this as discrimination against black women specifically, the example itself has two components: rape on the basis of femaleness and failure of legal protection on the basis of blackness. When she says their femaleness made them sexually vulnerable to racist domination, she seems to mean that the rape itself is about blackness. McKinnon's discussion of rape and genocide supports Crenshaw's suggestion that rape is sometimes about race or ethnicity. She says, many of these acts, rape and war, make women's bodies into a medium of men's expression, the means through which one group of men says what it wants to say to another. Apart from affirming manhood, which rape always does, rape and war thus serves as a specific psychological warfare and a method of communication, providing symbolic as well as actual reward and symbolic as well as actual revenge. It means supremacy, we are better than you, and possession, we own you. Here, rape is deployed for the purpose of racial conquest, and in that sense is done to women on the basis of race. But it achieves this purpose only because it is done to women specifically. That is, rape means we are better than you and we own you only in a context in which men are defined by their sexual ownership of women, such that to rape their women is to claim ownership of what is theirs, to unman them. Here, one group racially discriminates against another by making use of sexual discrimination. This is discrimination that is the sum of its parts, racial discrimination plus sexual discrimination. In another example, Crenshaw explains how the circumstances of black women's lives have compelled them to work outside the home in much greater numbers than white women, thus preventing them from adhering to norms of femininity, such as being physically delicate. Again, the oppression she describes seems to be the sum of racism and sexism. Racism is the cause of the poverty that has compelled them to work outside the home, and this interacts with sexism, which imposes norms of femininity on women. This does not appear to be a unique form of oppression. It is precisely the sum of its parts. There are three conceptual categories here. Oppression can be one part, for example, sex. It can be the sum of its parts, for example, race and sex. And it can be more than the sum of its parts, for example, a novel race/sex intersection. Crenshaw's examples are arguably of the second category. It's not entirely clear what it would take to demonstrate the difference between the second category and the third. Advocates of intersectionality, at least if understood as we've characterized the metaphysical and explanatory/explanatory priority types, owe us a theory of the third category. What they can't do is simply insist upon it without a theory and without examples that can't be adequately explained by one of the other two categories. And what they shouldn't do is pretend to already have that theory and insist that single-axis feminist theory concede to it. When feminists began arguing with Marxists for the inclusion of feminist issues within Marxism, they eventually discovered that this wouldn't work, and they began to build an independent theory. It's puzzling why this hasn't happened with intersectionality. Instead of ending up with two strong independent theories, one single-axis and one multi-axis, feminism has become synonymous with intersectionality without a theory. While Crenshaw's examples may not have fully demonstrated that intersectional oppression is more than the sum of its parts, Davis's and the On the Record examples suffice to that. So we can accept that some oppression is more than the sum of its parts, and some oppression is just its parts. What would the ratio of this more than the sum of its parts oppression relative to ordinary single axis oppression have to be in order for it to be justified to insist upon an intersectional approach to feminism? If it's usually that only one axis is in operation, or that when multiple axes are in operation, their effects are additive, then it would seem strange to demand that feminism take an intersectional approach. That would mean to miss out on the overwhelming proportion of female oppression that is not intersectional, simply because of the tiny proportion that is. That is to say, women everywhere are oppressed on the basis of sex, whether or not they are also oppressed on the basis of other social categories, and or also multiply oppressed in a way that is more than the sum of its parts. That might be a reason to add intersectional oppression into the feminist project, but it's no reason at all to displace the one with the other. Both Spellman and Hooks, however, seem to be advocating displacement. At this point, we can track the implications of two different answers to the question of whether intersectional oppression is more than the sum of its parts. It will be useful to consider figure one as levels of combination, with single axis categories at the lowest level and categories with the greatest number of intersections at the highest level, assuming for simplicity there are just three. Suppose that intersectional oppression is more than the sum of its parts, or suppose of all the intersectional oppression that there is, that at least some is more than the sum of its parts, and that's the oppression we're talking about. In this case, it is not reducible to its parts. That means we cannot work out the higher level category, race slash sex slash class, just by working out the lower level categories, race, sex, class. This might seem to vindicate the intersectional claim. But note that, similarly, we cannot work out any lower level category, for example sex, just by working out the higher level category, race slash sex slash class. At first glance, then, Bernstein is wrong to say that the higher level categories explain the lower level categories, that being a black woman explains being black and being a woman. Because the intersectional category is more than its parts, it cannot be reduced or separated out into its parts. There's no reverse engineering from the intersectional category back to the parts. If intersectional oppression is more than the sum of its parts, then we need all the levels. Some might be more relevant for our particular purposes, but noticing that there is intersectional oppression is no argument at all for giving priority to the intersectional category over the single axis categories. It's at best an argument for including intersectional categories alongside the single axis categories. Bernstein need not be read as suggesting that we can reverse engineer. She might say the higher level categories explain the lower level ones, not because they can be disaggregated into them, but because they are the sources of information for them. This inverts our diagram. The intersectional category is now the lower level category and the individual identity constituent the higher level one, figure two. We work out the content of the individual identity constituent by feeding information from the intersectional category up into it. For example, we work out the content of sex by feeding all of the information from sex slash race slash class up into sex. This avoids the reverse engineering problem. The higher level categories now contain nothing more than the summed content of the lower ones. But this has a troubling implication. Women's oppression qua women is no longer one particular way in which all women are oppressed, but the sum of the ways in which all of the intersectional categories of women as people are oppressed. And it is difficult to see how any significant number of women could be thus oppressed, and certainly could thus be oppressed qua women. Accepting Bernstein's interpretation, then, means relinquishing the idea that women are oppressed qua women. Crenshaw did not intend this. She believed that all women were oppressed as women, but that black women were also oppressed as black women. nor, we think, does Bernstein intend this. She says, for example, a central tenet of intersectional theorizing is that blackness and womanhood mix and interact in such a way that one or the other or both separately do not exhaust the explanatory space of black womanhood. The key term here is exhaust. This allows that blackness, womanhood, and their interaction partially occupy the explanatory space of black womanhood. Bernstein's interpretation may give us the resources to cover the remaining explanatory space, but it deprives us of those to cover the space occupied by both womanhood and the interaction of blackness and womanhood. This inversion of our diagram, figure 2, also has the effect of introducing substantial overlap between the higher level single axis categories. Most of sex is the same as most of race, because we fed up information about each from the race/sex/class intersections. And this meant feeding in a lot of information that is not about sex and not about race on the old understandings of single axis categories. It is an empirical question exactly how much overlap there would be, and whether the differences between the categories, where they do not overlap, would be useful and illuminating. We suspect that these revised categories would be a lot less useful and illuminating than they are on the original version of the diagram, figure 1. Can this problem be patched? Perhaps we work out the content of the individual identity constituent by feeding only certain information from the intersectional category up into it, say, the woman part of the information. But to do that, we'd have to have a separate understanding of what it is to be oppressed as a woman, making the intersectional category parasitic on a prior conceptual understanding of the single axis categories, which poses the question, if we can extract that information from the intersectional category, why think we must begin with the intersectional category? But then there's an open question about how to best accommodate intersectional categories. It's not clear why it's feminism's job, rather than the job of any other single-axis movement. Perhaps the anti-racist movement should absorb the intersectional categories, and feminism should remain single-axis, for example. If every single-axis theory and movement incorporates the intersectional categories, there'll be a lot of doubling up. It might be most efficient for a new intersectional justice movement to develop, taking care of the intersectional categories. The point is that none of this is settled simply by noticing that there are intersectional categories whose oppression is more than the sum of its parts. Let us address two objections at this point. First, if we assume identity politics in the sense the Combahee River Collective had in mind, and we defend single-axis feminism as focused on sex, and new movements for either each distinct intersection, as black feminism was the intersection of race and sex oppression, or the plurality of intersections, which becomes a generalized global justice movement focused on all oppressions, as the UN now characterizes feminism, then it might seem that feminism is left to the most privileged women. Identity politics tells us that everyone oppressed by more than just sex should leave to fight their own more complex battles. But if that would be the outcome, wouldn't it be better to just accept intersectional feminism, rather than end up with a feminism by and for the most privileged women? We certainly don't want to be arguing for the transformation of feminism into the familiar caricature of second wave feminism. There are two responses we can give, however. The first is that even if it were the most privileged women left behind doing feminism, the feminist agenda itself would not be in the interests of the most privileged women. The single-axis feminist agenda is women's oppression qua women, and this means advancing the interests of some of the worst-off women in the world. It is likely to include issues like female genital mutilation, child brides, child abuse, sex trafficking, military prostitution, rape, sexual harassment, and more. Even if it focused on sex-based issues affecting a majority of women rather than the worst-off women, that would still mean a focus on issues that affected women oppressed by more than just sex. For example, it would be likely to include abortion and reproductive rights, maternal health, welfare services, women's health research, the gathering of sex data to combat the data gap and improve women's safety and women's services, women's legal services, and more. The second response is that it is highly unlikely to be just the most privileged women left behind doing feminism. It is just not the case that people care equally about all aspects of their identities. Some people don't care or positively disdain some such aspects. For example, there are LGB people who are utterly uninterested in LGB politics. Others care more about others' oppression. Yet others identify a state of primary emergency, which is the aspect of their identity that they think has the greatest negative impact on their lives, and want to work against that. In a volume on lesbian identities, Barbara Copper identified ageism as her primary state of emergency, connecting it with righteous rejections, trashings, and betrayals. There may be many women who are multiply oppressed and yet either care the most or care exclusively about feminism, or who see their womanhood as their primary state of emergency. Second, a defender of intersectionality might argue that it is a method rather than a metaphysical thesis. The method acts as a remedy to past mistakes. It is not that there's anything wrong with single-axis feminism. It's that there's something wrong with a feminism that universalizes the oppression of a specific group of women to the exclusion of other women, especially when that specific group is privileged women. It is common for critics of single-axis feminism to conflate single-axis with white feminism, as for example Nora Berenstain does when she says, "White feminism takes only a single-axis approach to gender-based oppression, describing it as a feminism that applies only to white, non-disabled, class-privileged, straight, cisgender citizens of Western, colonial, and settler-colonial nation-states, while it masquerades as universal." Intersectionality as method might be little more than a reminder that, even when concerned with women qua women, we must be careful to consider the oppression of all women, or a representative sample of women, to make sure that we don't mistakenly generalize from some women to all in ways that are not applicable to all. We have no objection to this understanding of intersectionality, but we think it is less substantive than most advocates of intersectionality have in mind, and it is certainly not what Berenstain is arguing for. We were supposing above that intersectional oppression was more than the sum of its parts. Now suppose, conversely, that intersectional oppression turns out to be just the sum of its parts. Or suppose, of all the intersectional oppression that there is, that at least some is just the sum of its parts. And that's the oppression we're talking about. One question we might ask in that case is about the relations between the lower and higher levels. Perhaps single-axis oppression composes intersectional oppression, or constitutes it, or is identical to it, or grounds it, or is a part of it. Berenstain takes grounding to be the best candidate for the relation between the lower level categories and the higher in giving a metaphysics of intersectionality. But notice that any of these, except identity, could be the correct description of the relation between the different levels, and it'd still be preferable to focus on the lower level, the composers, the constitutors, the grounds, the parts. Traditional metaphysicians generally prefer to focus on the lower level, although with the exception of the metaphysical holists, and social metaphysicians generally prefer to focus on the higher level, although with the exception of the metaphysical reductionists. So a second and better question we might ask is whether, when it comes to intersectional oppression, we should be more like the traditional metaphysicians or more like the social metaphysicians. There are several reasons that explain why the social metaphysicians generally prefer to focus on the higher level phenomena. So we should figure out whether, as feminists, we share those reasons. As Christian List and Kai Speakerman explain, full and satisfying explanations of things often require the higher level and not just the lower level, And sometimes it's the higher level that's salient because the same outcome could have been achieved in many different lower level ways. Our favorite example of the former comes from the evolutionary biologist's concept of group selection. Take the group to be the higher level corresponding to the intersectional category, and the individual to be the lower level corresponding to the single axis category. A simplified version of group selection goes like this. Each of the individuals in a group performs actions that benefit one another in terms of their chances of survival and reproduction, even though not all of these actions are such that they would be justified by the survival and reproduction interests of the individual alone. A group whose individual members are acting like this outperforms another group whose individual members are not acting like this in terms of survival and reproduction. That is, more of its members survive and reproduce. If we only looked at the lower level of individuals, all we would see is some people acting for their own survival and reproduction interests and some not, and some of those who were not surprisingly doing rather well anyway. We need to look at the higher level of the group and what is going on between groups to understand what sorts of reciprocity are in play and between whom and how they benefit the group. Group selection as a name suggests that selection is literally operating at the level of the group, but you don't have to believe that to think a full explanation of the selection effects in such a case requires knowing what's going on at the level of groups. List and Speakerman say there are three jointly necessary and sufficient conditions for requiring a focus on the higher level for explanation. These are: there are properties that correspond to different levels, for example, soccer players kick the ball, but soccer teams win matches. Many different constellations of lower level properties counterfactually determine the same higher level properties. For example, the team wins the match because of the moves made by the players on the day, but different players could have made the same moves, or the same players could have made different moves, and the team could still have won. And the higher level properties can be causes regardless of the specific constellation of the lower level properties. For example, because the team wins the match, the country wins the World Cup, even though what we said to explain the last point is still true. Although this justification is given in terms of explanation, like Bernstein's, there's a stronger link to the metaphysical in virtue of the fact that it would be surprising if our best social sciences quantified over particular entities which meet the three conditions List and Speakerman gave, and yet which don't actually exist. If there are properties at the level of the team, and many different ways the players could have been determine the same way the team could have been, and teams can be causes of the same things, regardless of the different ways the players might have been, then there are most likely teams. This disambiguation of the intersectional imperative has a stronger claim to being genuinely metaphysical. All this being said, it's worth bearing in mind that holists in political science and anti-reductionists, collectivists, more generally across the social sciences and humanities, are not fighting to displace individualistic / lower level explanations, but simply to have a seat at the table with them. Theorists argue that these higher level explanations are also interesting and important. No one thinks there aren't really any players that make up a team or any atoms that make up a table. They just want to be able to talk about teams and tables. The intersectional approach is not so ecumenical, or at least not in some of its formulations. In Spellman's formulation, it displaces. There is no category women. And generalizing her reasoning, there would be no category black or working class. There are only intersectional categories like black lesbian woman or working class disabled woman. In Hooke's formulation too, it displaces. There is a category woman, but our attention should be on sex and race and class, or on sex/race/class. We asked above, do feminists share these reasons? We're not so sure that they do, given these dissimilarities in goals. We surely do not want to lose the ability to talk about just sex-based oppression, even if we also want the ability to talk about sex slash race oppression and sex slash class oppression and sex slash race slash class oppression. Crenshaw appears to agree with this, writing, "To bring this back to a non-metaphorical level, I am suggesting that Black women can experience discrimination in ways that are both similar to and different from those experienced by white women and Black men. If Black women experience some discrimination on the basis of only sex, similar to some white women, then Black women too have an interest in non-intersectional feminism, a form of feminism concerned with sex alone. Racism, sexism, and classism are, after all, systems of oppression that arose out of different historical events and have had lasting effects through different sorts of political and institutional structures and which affect people's beliefs and attitudes, and in turn biases and stereotypes, in different ways. We have good reason to retain the ability to distinguish them, whether or not we choose to make use of it. None of the reasons identified by List and Speakerman clearly and straightforwardly applies." Section 3. So, should feminism be intersectional? We draw 5 lessons from the preceding discussion. First, there are at least 6 different things that might be meant by the claim that feminism had better be intersectional. These are seldom, if ever, distinguished. Which of them is meant affects whether the claim is true, and once disambiguated, none makes it obviously true. Second, even if feminism should be intersectional on one of the interpretations, it should clearly not be only intersectional on most of them. The law should protect against single-axis oppression. Some good explanations are single-axis. This means the intersectionality claim is often overstated, in particular where it seems to displace rather than supplement slash complement existing single-axis approaches to feminism. Third, many theorists of intersectionality seem to be making a metaphysical claim, but seldom offer any empirical evidence to support it. More research is needed in order to ascertain the extent to which intersectional oppression is more or less than the sum of its parts, and in particular, whether what oppresses, for example, racism and sexism, is more or less than the sum of its parts, rather than whether what it is like to be oppressed feels like more or less than the sum of its parts. Fourth, if the relation between elements of intersectional oppression is additive after all, then there is no reason for feminism to take up oppression on the basis of other features of identity as its cause. It would be perfectly consistent for feminism to be about sex and sex-related oppression, and other theories and movements to be about the intersectional categories. Although, in order for feminism to do its single-axis job well, it may need to take up oppression on the basis of other features of identity as an interpersonal matter. Fifth, and finally, there's nothing about the general observation that multiple identity features can intersect that is naturally limited to feminism. If this is a good observation, it's relevant to all justice movements, and because uptake by each would mean significant overlap, it's not obvious that uptake by each is a better answer than uptake by a new, dedicated, intersectional justice movement. Had feminism better be intersectional? Not if this means intersectional instead of single axis. At best, feminism should be also intersectional on one of its possible disambiguations. You can find the published version of this paper with all footnotes, references, and figures available at philpapers.org, either by searching the title, The Metaphysics of Intersectionality Revisited, or either of the author names, Kate Phelan or Holly Lawford-Smith.
Thanks again for tuning in. You can find more of Holly's work on her website, hollylawford-smith.org. You can support her work by purchasing her recent book, Gender Critical Feminism, which is available from major booksellers, including Amazon.